Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein, continued. Cassette 7, Side 2. The sermon seemed to be directed at him, too, but he could not understand it. The words were English, but they seemed to be put together wrongly, and there was so much noise, so much clapping, so many shouts of hallelujah and happy day, that he grew quite confused. The sermon ended. Digby turned the service back to the young priest and left. Boone stood up.
Come, folks, we'll sneak out ahead of the crowd.
Mike followed, Jill's hand in his. Presently they were going through an elaborately arched tunnel. Jubal said,
Does this lead to the parking lot? I told my driver to wait.
Eh?
Boone answered.
Yeah, straight ahead. But we're going to see the Supreme Bishop.
What?
Jubal replied.
No, it's time for us to go.
Boone stared.
Doctor, the Supreme Bishop is waiting. You must pay your respects. You're his guests.
Jubal gave in.
Well, there won't be a lot of people. This boy's had enough excitement.
Just the Supreme Bishop.
Boone ushered them into an elevator. Moments later, they were in a parlor of Digby's apartments. A door opened. Digby hurried in. He had removed his vestments and was dressed in flowing robes. He smiled. Sorry to keep you waiting, folks.
I have to shower as soon as I come off. You've no notion how it makes you sweat to punch Satan.
So this is the man from Mars? God bless you, son. Welcome to the Lord's house. Archangel Foster wants you to feel at home. He's watching over you. Mike did not answer. Jubal was surprised to see how short Digby was. Lifts in his shoes on stage? Or the lighting? Aside from the goatee he wore in imitation of Foster, the man reminded Jubal of a used car salesman, the same smile and warm manner. But he reminded Jubal of someone in particular.
Got it. Professor Simon Magus.
Becky Veazey's long-dead husband. Jubal felt friendlier toward the clergyman. Simon had been as likable a scoundrel as he had ever known. Digby turned his charm on Jill. Don't kneel, daughter. We're just friends in private here. He spoke with her, startling Jill with knowledge of her background, and adding earnestly, I have deep respect for your calling, daughter. In the blessed words of Archangel Foster, God commands us to minister to the body, in order that the soul may seek the light untroubled by the flesh. I know that you are not yet one of us, but your service is blessed by the Lord. We are fellow travelers on the road to heaven. He turned to Jubal. You too, doctor. Archangel Foster tells us that the Lord commands us to be happy. And many is the time I have put down my crook, weary unto death, and enjoyed a happy hour over one of your stories. Stood up refreshed, ready to fight again.
Thank you, Bishop.
I mean it deeply. I've had your record searched in heaven. Now, never mind. I know that you are an unbeliever. Even Satan has a purpose in God's great plan. It is not time for you to believe. Out of your sorrow and heartache and pain, you spin happiness for others. This is credited on your page of the great ledger. Now, please, I did not bring you here to argue theology. We never argue. We wait until you see the light and then welcome you. Today we shall just enjoy a happy hour together. Jubal conceded that the glib fraud was a good host. His coffee and liquor and food were excellent. Mike seemed jumpy, especially when Digby got him aside and spoke with him alone. But confound it, the boy had to get used to meeting people. Boone was showing Jill relics of Foster in a case on the other side of the room. Jubal watched with amusement while he spread pâté de foie gras on toast. He heard a door click and looked around. Digby and Mike were missing.
Where did they go, Senator?
Hey, what was that, Doctor?
Bishop Digby and Mr. Smith. Where are they?
Boone seemed to notice the closed door.
Oh, they've stepped in there for a moment. There's a retiring room for private audiences. Weren't you in it when the Supreme Bishop was showing you around?
Yes.
It was a room with a chair on a dais. A throne, Jubal corrected himself with a grin. And a kneeler. Jubal wondered which one would use the throne and which would be stuck with the kneeler. If this tinsel bishop tried to argue religion with Mike, he was in for shocks.
I hope they don't stay long.
I doubt if they will. Probably Mr. Smith wanted a word in private. Look, I'll have your cab wait at the end of that passageway where we took the elevator. That's the Supreme Bishop's private entrance. Save you a good 10 minutes.
That's very kind.
So if Mr. Smith has something on his soul he wants to confess, we won't have to hurry him. I'll step outside and phone.
Boone left. Jill said, Jubal, I don't like this. I think we were deliberately maneuvered so that Digby could get Mike alone.
Obviously.
They haven't any business doing that. I'm going to bust in and tell Mike it's time to leave.
Suit yourself, Jubal answered. But you're acting like a broody hen. If Digby tries to convert Mike, they'll wind up with Mike converting him. Mike's ideas are hard to shake.
I still don't like it.
Relax. Help yourself to chow.
I'm not hungry.
If I turned down a free feed, they'd toss me out of the Authors Guild.
He piled Virginia ham on buttered bread, added other items in an unsteady ziggurat, munched it. 10 minutes later, Boone had not returned. Jill said sharply, Jubal, I'm going to get Mike out of there.
Go ahead.
She strode to the door.
It's locked.
Thought it might be.
What do? Break it down?
Jubal looked it over.
With a battering ram and 20 stout men, I might try. Jill, that door would do credit to a vault.
What do?
Beat on it if you want to. I'm going to see what's keeping Boone.
When Jubal looked out into the hallway, he saw Boone returning.
Sorry, Boone said. Had to have the cherubim find your driver. He was in the happiness room having lunch.
Senator, Jubal said, we've got to leave. Will you be so kind as to tell Bishop Digby?
Boone looked perturbed.
I could phone if you insist, but I can't walk in on a private audience.
Then phone him.
Boone was saved embarrassment. The door opened, and Mike walked out. Jill looked at his face and shrilled,
Mike, are you all right?
Yes, Jill.
I'll tell the Supreme Bishop you're leaving, said Boone,
and went into the smaller room. He reappeared at once.
He's left, he announced. There's a back way into his study.
Boone smiled.
Like cats and cooks, the Supreme Bishop goes without saying. That's a joke. He says that goodbyes add nothing to happiness. Don't be offended.
We aren't. Thank you for a most interesting experience. No, don't bother. We can find our way out.
Chapter 24. Once in the air, Jubal said,
Mike, what did you think of it?
Mike frowned.
I do not grok.
You aren't alone, son. What did the bishop have to say?
Mike hesitated a long time.
My brother Jubal, I need to ponder until grokking is.
Ponder ahead, son.
Jill said, Jubal, how do they get away with it?
With what?
Everything. That's not a church. It's a madhouse.
No, Jill. It is a church. And the logical eclecticism of our time.
Huh?
The new revelation is old stuff. Neither Foster nor Digby ever had an original thought. They pieced together time-worn tricks, gave them a new paint job, and were in business. A booming business. The thing that bothers me is that I might live to see it made compulsory for everybody.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Hitler started with less, and all he peddled was hate. For repeat trade, happiness is sound of merchandise. I know I'm in the same grift, as Digby reminded me.
Jubal grimaced.
I should have punched him. Instead, he made me like it. That's why I'm afraid of him. He's clever. He knows what people want. Happiness. The world has suffered a long century of guilt and fear. Now Digby tells them that they have nothing to fear, this life or hereafter, and that God commands them to be happy. Day in, day out, he keeps pushing it. Don't be afraid. Be happy.
Well, that's all right, Jill admitted. And he does work hard, but...
Piffle. He plays hard.
No, he gave me the impression that he really is devoted, that he had sacrificed everything to...
Piffle, I said.
Jill, of all the nonsense that twists the world, the concept of altruism is the worst. People do what they want to every time. If it pains them to make a choice, if the choice looks like a sacrifice, you can be sure that it is no nobler than the discomfort caused by greediness, the necessity of deciding between two things you want when you can't have both. The ordinary bloke suffers every time he chooses between spending a buck on beer or tucking it away for his kids, between getting up to go to work or losing his job, but he always chooses what hurts least or pleasures most. The scoundrel and the saint make the same choices on a larger scale, as Digby does. Saint or scoundrel, he's not one of the harried chumps.
Which do you think he is, Jubal?
There's a difference?
Oh, Jubal, your cynicism is a pose. Of course there's a difference.
Yes, there is. I hope he's a scoundrel, because a saint can stir up 10 times as much mischief. Strike that last, you would tag it cynicism, as if tagging it proved it wrong. Jill, what troubled you about those services?
Well, everything. You can't tell me that that is worship.
Meaning they didn't do things that way in the little brown church you attended as a kid? Brace yourself, Jill. They don't do it your way in St. Peter's either, nor in Mecca.
Yes, but... Well, none of them do it that way. Snake dances, slot machines, even a bar. That's not even dignified.
I don't suppose temple prostitution was dignified either.
Huh?
I imagine the two-back beast is as comical in the service of a god as it is under other circumstances. As for snake dances, have you ever seen a shaker service? Neither have I. A church that is against sexual intercourse doesn't last. But dancing to the glory of God has a long history. It doesn't have to be autistic. The shakers could never have made the Bolshoi. It merely has to be enthusiastic. Do you find Indian rain dances irreverent?
That's different.
Everything always is. And the more it changes, the more it is the same. Now, slot machines. Ever see a bingo game in church?
Well, yes, our parish used them to raise the mortgage. But only on Friday nights. We didn't do such things during church services.
So? Reminds me of a wife who was proud of her virtue, slept with other men only when her husband was away.
Jubal, the two cases are miles apart.
Probably. Analogy is even slipperier than logic. But, little lady...
Smile when you say that.
It's a joke, Jill. If a thing is sinful on Sunday, it is sinful on Friday. At least it groks that way to me. And perhaps to a man from Mars. The only difference I see is that the Fosterites give away, absolutely free, a scriptural text even if you lose. Could your bingo games make that claim?
Fake scripture? A text from the New Revelation. Boss, have you read the thing?
I've read it.
Then you know. It's just dressed up in biblical language. Part is icky, sweet, more is nonsense, and some is just hateful. Jubal was silent a long time. At last he said,
Jill, are you familiar with Hindu sacred writings?
I'm afraid not.
The Quran? Any other major scripture? I could illustrate my point from the Bible, but do not wish to hurt your feelings.
You won't hurt my feelings.
Well, I'll use the Old Testament. Picking it to pieces usually doesn't upset people as much. You know about Sodom and Gomorrah? How Lot was saved from these wicked cities when Yahweh smote them?
Oh, of course. His wife was turned into a pillar of salt.
Always seemed to me a stiff punishment. But we were speaking of Lot. Peter describes him as a just, godly, and righteous man, vexed by the filthy conversation of the wicked. St. Peter must be an authority on virtue, since to him were given the keys to the kingdom of heaven. But it is hard to see what made Lot such a paragon. He divided a cattle range at his brother's suggestion. He got captured in battle. He lammed out of town to save his skin. He fed and sheltered 2 strangers, but his conduct shows that he knew them to be VIPs. And by the Koran and by my own lights, his hospitality would count more if he had thought they were mere beggars. Aside from these items and St. Peter's character reference, there's only one thing in the Bible on which we can judge Lot's virtue. Virtue so great that heavenly intercession saved his life. See Genesis 19, verse 8.
What does it say?
Look it up. I don't expect you to believe me.
Jubal, you're the most infuriating man I've ever met.
And you're a very pretty girl, so I don't mind your ignorance. All right, but look it up later. Lot's neighbors beat on his door and wanted to meet these blokes from out of town. Lot didn't argue. He offered a deal. He had 2 daughters, virgins, so he said. He told this mob that he would give them these girls and they could use them any way they liked. A gang shagging. He pleaded with them to do any damn thing they pleased, only quit beating on his door.
Jubal, does it really say that?
I've modernized the language. But the meaning is as unmistakable as a whore's wink. Lot offered to let a gang of men, young and old, the Bible says, abuse 2 young virgins, if only they wouldn't break down his door. Say,
Jubal beamed.
I should have tried that when the SS was breaking down my door. Maybe it would have got me into heaven.
He frowned.
No, the recipe calls for virginis intacti. And I wouldn't have known which of you gals to offer.
You won't find out from me.
Well, even Lot might have been mistaken, but that's what he promised. His virgin daughters, young and tender and scared, urged this gang to rape them, if only they would leave him in peace.
Jubal snorted.
The Bible cites this scum as a righteous man.
Jill said slowly, I don't think that's the way we were taught it in Sunday school.
Damn it, look it up. That's not the only shock in store for anybody who reads the Bible. Consider Elisha. Elisha was so old fired holy that touching his bones restored a dead man to life. He was a bald-headed old coot like myself. One day children made fun of his baldness, just as you girls do. So God sent bears to tear 42 children into bloody bits. That's what it says, second chapter of 2 Kings.
Boss, I never make fun of your bald head.
Who sent my name to those hair restore quacks? Whoever it was, God knows. And she had better keep a sharp eye for bears. The Bible is loaded with such stuff. Crimes that turn your stomach are asserted to be divinely ordered or divinely condoned. Along with, I must add, hard common sense and workable rules for social behavior. I'm not running down the Bible. It isn't a patch on the pornographic trash that passes as sacred writings among Hindus or a dozen other religions. But I'm not condemning them either. It is conceivable that one of these mythologies is the Word of God. That God is, in truth, the sort of paranoid who rends to bits 42 children for sassing his priest. Don't ask me about the front office. I just work here. My point is that Foster's new revelation is sweetness and light, as Scripture goes. Bishop Digby's patron is a good Joe. He wants people to be happy. Happy on earth, plus eternal bliss in heaven. He doesn't expect you to chastise the flesh. Oh, no. This is the giant economy package. If you like to drink and gamble and dance and wench, come to church and do it under holy auspices. Do it with your conscience free. Have fun at it. Live it up. Get happy.
Jubal failed to look happy.
Of course there's a charge. Digby's God expects to be acknowledged. Anyone stupid enough to refuse to get happy on his terms is a sinner and deserves anything that happens to him. But this rule is common to all gods. Don't blame Foster and Digby. Their snake oil is orthodox in all respects.
Boss, you sound halfway converted.
Not me. I don't enjoy snake dances. I despise crowds. And I do not let slobs tell me where to go on Sundays. I simply object to your criticizing them for the wrong things. As literature, the New Revelation stacks up about average. It should. It was composed by plagiarizing other scriptures. As for internal logic, mundane rules do not apply to sacred writings, but here the new revelation must be rated superior. It hardly ever bites its own tail. Try reconciling the Old Testament with the New, or Buddhist doctrine with Buddhist apocrypha. As morals, Fosterism is the Freudian ethic sugar-coated for people who can't take psychology straight, although I doubt if the old lecher who wrote it, pardon me, was inspired to write it, knew this. He was no scholar. But he was in tune with his times. He tapped the zeitgeist. Fear and guilt and loss of faith. How could he miss? Pipe down. I'm going to nap.
Who's talking?
The woman tempted me.
Jubal closed his eyes. On reaching home, they found that Caxton and Mahmood had flown in for the day. Ben had been disappointed to find Jill away, but had managed to bear up through the company of Anne, Miriam, and Dorcas. Mahmood always visited for the avowed purpose of seeing Mike and Dr. Harshaw. However, he too had shown fortitude at having only Jubal's food, liquor, garden, and odalisques to entertain him. Miriam was rubbing his back while Dorcas rubbed his head. Jubal looked at him.
Don't get up.
I can't. She's sitting on me. Hi, Mike.
Hi, my brother Stinky Dr. Mahmood. Mike then gravely greeted Ben and asked to be excused.
Run along, son, Jubal told him.
Anne said,
Mike, have you had lunch?
He said solemnly,
Anne, I am not hungry.
Thank you.
Turned and went into the house. Mahmood twisted, almost unseating Miriam.
Jubal, what's troubling our son?
Yeah, said Ben, he looks seasick. Let him be. An overdose of religion.
Jubal sketched the morning's events. Mahmood frowned.
Was it necessary to leave him alone with Digby? This seems to me, pardon me, my brother, unwise.
Stinky, he's got to take such things in stride. You've preached theology at him, he told me. Can you name one reason why Digby shouldn't have his innings? Answer as a scientist, not as a Muslim.
I am unable to answer anything other than as a Muslim, Dr. Mahmoud said quietly.
Sorry. I recognize your necessity, even though I disagree.
Jubal, I use the word Muslim in its exact sense, not as a sectarian, which Miriam incorrectly terms Mohammedan. Which I'll go on calling you until you learn to pronounce Miriam. Quit squirming.
Yes, Miriam.
Ouch! Women should not be muscular. Jubal, as a scientist, I find Michael the prize of my career. As a Muslim, I find in him a willingness to submit to the will of God. And this makes me happy for his sake, although there are difficulties, and as yet he does not grok what the English word God means.
He shrugged.
Nor the Arabic word, Allah. But as a man, and always a slave of God, I love this lad, our foster son and water brother, and would not have him under bad influences. Aside from creed, this Digby strikes me as a bad influence. What do you think?
Olay! Ben applauded. He's a slimy bastard. I haven't exposed his racket in my column simply because the syndicate is afraid to print it. Stinky, keep talking, and you'll have me studying Arabic and buying a rug.
I hope so. The rug is not necessary.
Jubal sighed.
I agree with you. I'd rather see Mike smoking marijuana than converted by Digby, but I don't think there's any danger of Mike's being taken in by that syncretic hodgepodge. And he's got to learn to stand up to bad influences. I consider you a good influence, but I don't think you stand much more chance. The boy has an amazingly strong mind. Muhammad may have to make way for a new prophet.
If God so wills,
Mahmoud answered.
That leaves no room for argument, Jubal agreed.
We were discussing religion before you got home, Dorcas said softly. Boss, did you know that women have souls?
They do.
So Stinky says.
Miriam, Mahmoud explained, wanted to know why we Mohammedans thought only men had souls.
Miriam, that's as vulgar a misconception as the notion that Jews sacrifice Christian babies. The Quran states that entire families enter into paradise, men and women together. For example, see Ornaments of Gold, verse 70, isn't it, Stinky?
Enter the garden, ye and your wives, to be made glad. That's as well as it can be translated, agreed Mahmoud. Well, said Miriam, I had heard about the beautiful houris that Mohammedan men have for playthings in paradise, and that didn't seem to leave room for wives.
Houris, said Jubal, are separate creations like jinni and angels. They don't need souls. They are spirits to start with, eternal, unchanging, and beautiful. There are male houris, too, or equivalents. Houris don't earn their way into paradise. They're on the staff. They serve delicious food and pass around drinks that never give hangovers and entertain as requested. But the souls of wives don't have to work. Correct, Stinky?
Close enough, aside from your flippant choice of words. The houris.
He sat up so suddenly that he dumped Miriam.
Say, perhaps you girls don't have souls.
Miriam said bitterly,
Why, you ungrateful dog of an infidel, take that back. Peace, Miriam. If you don't have a soul, then you're immortal anyhow. Jubal, is it possible for a man to die and not notice it?
Can't say. Never tried it.
Could I have died on Mars and just dreamed that I came home? Look around you, a garden the prophet himself would envy. Four beautiful houris serving lovely food and delicious drinks at all hours. Even their male counterparts, if you want to be fussy. Is this paradise?
I guarantee it ain't, Jubal assured him. My taxes are due.
Still, that doesn't affect me.
And take these houris, even if we stipulate that they are of adequate beauty. After all, beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
They pass. And you'll pay for that, boss,
Miriam added.
There still remains, Jubal pointed out, one requisite attribute of houris.
Said Mahmoud. We need not go into that. In paradise, rather than a temporary physical condition, it would be a permanent spiritual attribute, yes?
In that case, Jubal said emphatically, I'm certain that these are not houris.
Mahmoud sighed.
Then I'll have to convert one.
Why one? There are places where you can have the full quota.
No, my brother. In the wise words of the prophet, while the legislations permit four, it is impossible to deal justly with more than one.
That's some relief. Which one?
We'll see. Miriam, Are you feeling spiritual? You go to hell. Houris indeed.
Jill?
Give me a break, Ben protested. I'm working on Jill.
Later, Jill.
Anne?
Sorry, I've got a date.
Dorcas, you're my last chance.
Stinky, she said softly. Just how spiritual do you want me to feel?
Mike went upstairs to his room, closed the door, got on the bed, assumed the fetal position, rolled up his eyes, swallowed his tongue, and slowed his heart. Jill did not like him to do this in the daytime, but did not object as long as he did not do it publicly. So many things he must not do publicly, but only this one aroused her ire. He had been waiting since leaving that room of terrible wrongness. He needed very badly to withdraw and try to grok. He had done something that Jill had told him not to. He felt a human urge to tell himself that it had been forced on him, but his Martian training did not permit this escape. He had arrived at cusp. Right action had been required. The choice had been his. He grokked that he had chosen correctly. But his water brother Jill had forbidden this choice. But that would have left no choice. This was contradiction. At cusp, choice is. By choice, spirit grows. Would Jill have approved had he taken other action? Not wasting food? No, he grokked that Jill's injunction covered that variant. At this point, the being sprung from human genes and shaped by Martian thought, who could never be either, completed one stage of his growth, burst out and ceased to be a nestling. The solitary loneliness of predestined free will was then his, and with it, Martian's serenity to embrace, cherish, savor its bitterness, accept its consequences. With tragic joy, he knew that this cusp was his, not Jill's. His water brother could teach, admonish, guide. But choice at cusp was not shared. Here was ownership, beyond sale, gift, hypothecation. Owner and owned grokked inseparable. He eternally was the action he had taken at cusp. Now that he knew himself to be self, he was free to grok ever closer to his brothers, merge without let. Self's integrity was and is and ever had been. Mike stopped to cherish all his brother selves, the many threes fulfilled on Mars, corporate and discorporate, the precious few on Earth, the unknown powers of three on Earth that would be his to merge with and cherish. Now that at last, long waiting, he grokked and cherished himself. Mike remained in trance. There was much to grok, loose ends to puzzle over and fit into his growing. All that he had seen and heard and been at the Archangel Foster Tabernacle, not just cusp when he and Digby had come face to face alone. Why Bishop Senator Boone made him warily uneasy. How Miss Dawn Ardent tasted like a water brother when she was not. The smell of goodness he had incompletely grokked in the jumping up and down and wailing. Jubal's conversations coming and going, Jubal's words troubled him most. He studied them, compared them with what he had been taught as a nestling, struggling to bridge between languages. The one he thought with and the one he was learning to think in. The word church, which turned up over and over again among Jubal's words, gave him knotty difficulty. There was no Martian concept to match it. Unless one took church and worship and God and congregation and many other words and equated them to the totality of the only world he had known during growing waiting, then forced the concept back into English in that phrase, which had been rejected by each differently, by Jubal, by Mahmud, by Digby. Thou art God. He was closer to understanding it in English now, although it could never have the inevitability of the Martian concept it stood for. In his mind he spoke simultaneously the English sentence and the Martian word, and felt closer grokking. Repeating it like a student, telling himself that the jewel is in the lotus, he sank into nirvana. Before midnight he speeded his heart, resumed normal breathing, ran down his checklist, uncurled, and sat up. He had been weary. Now he felt light and gay and clear-headed, ready for the many actions he saw spreading out before him. He felt a puppyish need for company as strong as his earlier necessity for quiet. He stepped out into the hall, was delighted to encounter a water brother.
Hi.
Oh, hello. Mike. My, you look chipper.
I feel fine. Where is everybody?
Asleep. Ben and Stinky went home an hour ago, and people started going to bed.
Oh.
Mike felt disappointed that Mahmood had left. He wanted to explain his new grokking. I ought to be asleep, too, but I felt like a snack. Are you hungry?
Sure I'm hungry.
Come on, there's some cold chicken, and we'll see what else. They went downstairs, loaded a tray lavishly. Let's take it outside. It's plenty warm.
A fine idea, Mike agreed.
Warm enough to swim, a real Indian summer. I'll switch on the floods.
Don't bother, Mike answered. I'll carry the tray.
He could see in almost total darkness. Jubal said that his night sight probably came from the conditions in which he had grown up, and Mike grokked this was true, but grokked that there was more to it. His foster parents had taught him to see. As for the night being warm, he would have been comfortable naked on Mount Everest, but his water brothers had little tolerance for changes in temperature and pressure. He was considerate of their weakness once he learned of it. But he was looking forward to snow, seeing for himself that each tiny crystal of the water of life was a unique individual, as he had read, walking barefoot, rolling in it. In the meantime, he was pleased with the warm night and the still more pleasing company of his water brother. Okay, take the tray. I'll switch on the underwater lights. That'll be plenty to eat by.
Fine.
Mike liked having light up through the ripples. It was a goodness, beauty. They picnicked by the pool, then lay back on the grass and looked at stars. Mike, there's Mars. It is Mars, isn't it? Or Antares?
It is Mars.
Mike, what are they doing on Mars? He hesitated. The question was too wide for the sparse English language.
On the side toward the horizon, the southern hemisphere, it is spring. Plants are being taught to grow.
Taught to grow? He hesitated. Larry teaches plants to grow. I have helped him.
But my people, Martians, I mean, I now grok, you are my people,
teach plants another way. In the other hemisphere, it is growing colder, and nymphs, those who stayed alive through the summer, are being brought into nests for quickening and more growing. He thought.
Of the humans we left at the equator, one has discorporated, and the others are sad.
Yes, I heard it in the news.
Mike had not heard it. He had not known it until asked. They should not be sad. Mr. Booker T. W. Jones, food technician first class, is not sad. The old ones have cherished him.
You knew him?
Yes, he had his own face, dark and beautiful. But he was homesick.
Oh, dear. Mike, do you ever get homesick? For Mars?
At first I was homesick, he answered. I was lonely always.
He rolled toward her and took her in his arms.
But now I am not lonely. I grok I shall never be lonely again.
Mike, darling.
They kissed and went on kissing.
Presently his water brother said breathlessly, Oh my, that was almost worse than the first time.
You are all right, my brother?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Kiss me again.
A long time later, by cosmic clock, she said,
Mike, is that... I mean, do you know?
I know. It is for growing closer. Now we grow closer.
Well, I've been ready a long time. Goodness, we all have, but... Never mind, dear. Turn just a little. I'll help.
As they merged, grokking together, Mike said softly and triumphantly, Thou art God. Her answer was not in words. Then, as their grokking made them ever closer, and Mike felt himself almost ready to discorporate, her voice called him back.
Oh, thou art God.
We grok God.
Chapter 25. On Mars, humans were building pressure domes for the male and female party that would arrive by next ship. This went faster than scheduled, as the Martians were helpful. Part of the time saved was spent on a preliminary estimate for a long-distance plan to free bound oxygen in the sands of Mars to make the planet more friendly to future human generations. The old ones neither helped nor hindered this plan. Time was not yet. Their meditations were approaching a violent cusp that would shape Martian art for many millennia. On Earth, elections continued, and a very advanced poet published a limited edition of verse consisting entirely of punctuation marks and spaces. Time magazine reviewed it and suggested that the Federation Assembly daily record should be translated into the medium. A colossal campaign opened to sell more sexual organs of plants, and Mrs. Joseph, shadow of greatness, Douglas, was quoted as saying, "I would no more sit down without flowers on my table than without serviettes." A Tibetan Swami from Palermo, Sicily, announced in Beverly Hills a newly discovered ancient yoga discipline for ripple breathing, which increased both prana and cosmic attraction between sexes. His chelas were required to assume the Matsyendra posture, dressed in hand-woven diapers, while he read aloud from Rig Veda, and an assistant guru examined their purses in another room. Nothing was stolen. The purpose was less immediate. The President of the United States proclaimed the first Sunday in November as National Grandmother's Day and urged America to say it with flowers. A funeral parlor chain was indicted for price-cutting. Fosterite bishops, after secret conclave, announced the church's second major miracle. Supreme Bishop Digby had been translated bodily to heaven and spot promoted to archangel, ranking with but after Archangel Foster. The glorious news had been held up pending heavenly confirmation of the elevation of a new Supreme Bishop, Huey Short, a candidate accepted by the Boone faction after lots had been cast repeatedly. L'Unità and Hoy published identical denunciations of Short's elevation. L'Osservatore Romano and the Christian Science Monitor ignored it. Times of India snickered at it, and the Manchester Guardian simply reported it. The Fosterites in England were few, but extremely militant. Digby was not pleased with his promotion. The man from Mars had interrupted him with his work half-finished, and that stupid jackass Short was certain to louse it up. Foster listened with angelic patience until Digby ran down, then said, "Listen, Junior, you're an angel now, so forget it. Eternity is no time for recriminations. You too were a stupid jackass until you poisoned me. Afterwards, you did well enough. Now that Short is Supreme Bishop, he'll do all right. He can't help it. Same as with the popes. Some of them were warts until they got promoted. Check with one of them. Go ahead. There's no professional jealousy here." Digby calmed down, but made one request. Foster shook his halo. "You can't touch him. You shouldn't have tried to. Oh, you can submit a requisition for a miracle if you want to make a fool of yourself, but I'm telling you it'll be turned down. You don't understand the system yet. The Martians have their own setup, different from ours, and as long as they need him, we can't touch him. They run their show their way. The universe has variety. Something for everybody. A fact you field workers often miss."
"You mean this punk can brush me aside and I've got to hold still for it?"
"I held still for the same thing, didn't I? I'm helping you now, am I not? Now look, there's work to be done and lots of it. The boss wants performance, not gripes. If you need a day off to calm down, duck over to the Muslim paradise and take it. Otherwise, straighten your halo, square your wings, and dig in. The sooner you act like an angel, the quicker you'll feel angelic. Get happy, Junior."
Digby heaved a deep, ethereal sigh. "Okay, I'm happy. Where do I start?"
Jubal did not hear of Digby's disappearance when it was announced, and when he did, while he had a fleeting suspicion, he dismissed it. If Mike had had a finger in it, he had gotten away with it. And what happened to Supreme Bishops worried Jubal not at all, as long as he wasn't bothered. His household had gone through an upset. Jubal deduced what had happened, but did not know with whom, and didn't want to inquire. Mike was of legal age and presumed able to defend himself in the clinches. Anyhow, it was high time the boy was salted. Jubal couldn't construct the crime from the way the girls behaved, because patterns kept shifting. ABC versus D, then BCD versus A, or AB versus CD, or AD versus CB, through all ways that four women can gang up on each other. This continued most of the week following that ill-starred trip to church, during which period Mike stayed in his room, and usually in a trance so deep that Jubal would have pronounced him dead had he not seen it before. Jubal would not have minded it if service had not gone to pieces. The girls seemed to spend half their time tiptoeing in to see if Mike was all right, and they were too preoccupied to cook, much less be secretaries. Even rock-steady Anne. Hell, Anne was the worst. Absent-minded, subject to unexplained tears. Jubal would have bet his life that if Anne were to witness the Second Coming, she would memorize date, time, personae, events, and barometric pressure without batting her calm blue eyes. Late Thursday, Mike woke himself, and suddenly it was ABCD in the service of Mike, less than the dust beneath his chariot wheels. The girls resumed giving Jubal service, so he counted his blessings and let it lie, except for a wry thought that, if he demanded a showdown, Mike could quintuple their salaries by a postcard to Douglas. But the girls would just as readily support Mike. With domestic tranquility restored, Jubal did not mind that his kingdom was ruled by a mayor of the palace. Meals were on time and better than ever. When he shouted front, the girl who appeared was bright-eyed, happy, and efficient. Such being the case, Jubal did not give a hoot who rated the most side boys or girls. Besides, the change in Mike was interesting. Before that week, Mike had been docile in a fashion that Jubal classed as neurotic. Now he was so self-confident that Jubal would have described it as cocky, had it not been that Mike continued to be unfailingly polite and considerate. He accepted homage from the girls as if a natural right. He seemed older than his age rather than younger. His voice deepened. He spoke with forcefulness rather than timidly. Jubal decided that Mike had joined the human race. He could discharge this patient. Except, Jubal reminded himself, on one point. Mike still did not laugh. He could smile at a joke, and sometimes did not ask to have them explained. Mike was cheerful, even merry. But he never laughed. Jubal decided that it was not important. This patient was sane, healthy, and human. Short weeks earlier, Jubal would have given odds against a cure. He was humble enough not to claim credit. The girls had had more to do with it. Or should he say, girl. From the first week of his stay, Jubal had told Mike almost daily that he was welcome, but that he should stir out and see the world as soon as he felt able. Jubal should not have been surprised when Mike announced one breakfast that he was leaving. But he was surprised, and to his greater surprise, hurt. He covered it by using his napkin unnecessarily.
So? When?
We're leaving today.